This evening I want to explore an aspect of practice which is very rarely explored. It's a little bit ironic because it's a very fundamental part of practice, and yet we often don't give too much attention to it, certainly not in talks. That is the area of living ethically. It might surprise some of you to hear that this is not taught so much. I think that's true, that we have so much an emphasis on meditation that we don't so much give a focus on the ethical dimension of practice, even though traditionally in Buddhist practice over the last 2,600 years, the ethical dimension of practice is one of three foundational areas. The three areas are sila, usually translated as ethics or morality, samadhi, which literally means concentration, but usually denotes the area of meditation, and then panya, which denotes the area of wisdom. So the area of sila, or ethics, is foundational. And if you were to study in Asia, you would certainly hear in many settings as much on living ethically as on meditation. But we, for different reasons, are very much focused, I think somewhat understandably, on meditation. Not even always so much on wisdom. I remember I was surprised when I first, a little bit after I moved to this area, I was asked to join with Sylvia Borstein to teach senior students at Spirit Rock. This was in the early 90s. And I designed a curriculum around a lot of different areas. And I actually found that most of the people who had been meditating for 10 or 15 years practicing didn't even know the basic teachings very well. So there's really this strong emphasis on meditation. Again, I can understand it from some perspectives, that interest in the experiential dimension of spirituality and some aversion coming from upbringing to the more dogmatic aspects of religious or spiritual teachings, right? And so it's understandable. And yet there are problems there, and I'll get to that in a bit. And so I was thinking about this topic partly in relationship to how I spent the last week and a half. I came back late on Wednesday from about 8 days in Washington, D.C. And I was actually staying downtown about three blocks from the White House, which was also near the National Mall. Many of you probably know Washington, D.C. And I was there for the 90th birthday of my aunt, who is Bernice's sister. Many of you know my mom, Bernice. And Judy was turning 90 and is in quite, you know, wonderful lucidity and pretty good health. And so we had an extended family gathering, and I basically was spending about half my time, typically the evenings and some of the afternoons, with family gatherings over about 8 days. And then in the mornings and many of the afternoons, I would go to museums that were not far away. I actually visited 7 museums in 8 days. Some of them I went back to more than once. And I was thinking about this theme of ethics in part, particularly from my visits to the relatively new Museum of African American History and Culture, which is very well done. Has anyone been there? Okay, yeah. It's not easy to get into. But that's another story. A lot of people want to go and you have to get passes. Anyway, so, and I also went to the Holocaust Museum, which I'd been to twice before. And I was thinking about the theme of ethics, and just and partly also, of course, in relationship to what was happening at the border with the separation of the children from their parents and so forth, and what probably somewhat charitably can be called governmentally sanctioned and institutionally supported child abuse. Right? I think that's fair, if not gentle. And a lot of people have used those kind of terms. But I also, it was also very interesting to go, for example, to the African American History and Culture Museum, which had a lot of the history exhibits on, of course, slavery and Jim Crow. And it was particularly interesting to see the history and how so many governmental leaders clearly knew that there was something wrong and unethical, and yet they went along with it. You could see that generation after generation in the, you know, in the reporting by the, you know, in the exhibits and so forth. One detail which I didn't know was that the original draft of the Declaration of Independence by Jefferson had passages involving the support of slavery in the original Declaration of Independence, you know, the one that says all men are created equal, right? And some of his, apparently some of his fellow co-signers of the original Declaration of Independence thought that the contradiction was too glaring. They weren't coming out against slavery, but let's not have that in our document, right? And that was interesting, right? That was in the original draft. You know, basically a statement, I think it was supportive of having slave auctions. Anyway, and you could see that throughout the history, people who claimed to be Christian, claimed to be ethical, were clearly, for reasons of power, influence, property, and so forth, were going against their ethical guidelines. And this went right through Jim Crow, right? You could see that. And there was also, there was some similar contradictions that could be seen also in the Holocaust Museum. There was a special exhibit on the U.S. response to the Holocaust, which, to be brief, was not very good. You know, and you could see that, again, they had some detail in the exhibit, and you could see that person after person spoke out against admitting too many immigrants. You know, and it was clearly, to some extent, based on anti-Semitism and kinds of racism, which were still prevalent at that time. And what I didn't know so well was that the State Department actually had as their official policy to minimize what was happening in the Holocaust and to suppress information, not make it public. I didn't know that so well. And again, they were, you know, it wasn't so clear where that was coming from, but I was just, you know, reflecting on this, that there were really, we would say, failures of integrity, ethical failings in, you know, throughout the history, right? And of course, many of us feel that we're in a kind of time now where probably many of us are asking, this goes against my ethics, what do I do? How do I act, right? can I act, right? And it's they're not easy questions to answer, right? But it seems like one dimension of ethical practice, and particularly related to a sense of ethical integrity, am I living what I purport to believe? Am I following the ethical guidelines that I think are right? Or am I giving in or compromising or doing something not all that different from what you could see throughout that history that I was mentioning, which is instructive, right? I think it's instructive. One of the types of questions that can give some energy to ethical inquiry is to ask, what would I have done in those circumstances? We know what a lot of people did, right? What would I have done? Because, you know, we can sometimes see the past with more ethical clarity than we can see the present. Anyway, so I want to explore that, but do so in both a traditional manner and a more contemporary manner, looking at some of the issues I just mentioned, but ground it really in traditional practice. And I also want to invite us to really give a focus on ethical practice, and I'll particularly focus on the first ethical precept, which is that of non-harming. And I'll talk about some ways to practice it and invite us to practice it in the next week, and then we'll come back a week from now and we'll share what we found. Yeah. And so I'm part of my motivation is to give some encouragement and energy for ethical practice as a fundamental mode of our practice. When you listen, for example, or look at some of the teachings of Achan Cha, you know, who was the teacher of Jack Kornfield, Achan Sumedho, who there's a 100th anniversary of his birth. And some of you, did anyone go to the event at Spirit Rock? Yeah. A very beautiful event, and if you look to the way he taught, this is in Thailand, and I think it's still pretty much the way teaching goes in that lineage, which we are really connected to, there was a continual emphasis on ethical practice, on the integrity, in part because practice was about living in community. And of course, because one had to see how one was acting in relation to the people around, and as well the other beings, non-human beings, as well. So traditionally, for a monk or nun, there were over 200 ethical guidelines that they followed, and they would chant the guidelines together, typically on the full moon, and take them. And in many communities, one focuses on the ethical precepts periodically, something we might even consider here. That I know in the Wednesday morning gathering, for about 20 years, we would once a month we would come early, we would formally take the ethical precepts, and then we would talk about our ethical practice together. It's a wonderful encouragement to see our ethical practice as part of our practice. So when we say, how's your practice going? We don't just think about one's formal sitting, right? We think about, because really practice is pointing to the entirety of our lives. Potentially 24/7. Potentially. It can come even into what you do when you're sleeping and dreaming. That's another topic. Okay. Okay, so for lay people, as I think most of us know, there are five ethical guidelines. And there are variants of non-harming. There's the precept to abstain from harming and taking the life of others. And in many settings, this was interpreted as all beings, not just human beings. The second guideline is about not taking that which is not given. The third guideline is to essentially be caring and careful in our sexual lives. And of course, for monks and nuns, it meant celibacy. The fourth lay guideline is to engage in skillful speech. That's something which we have looked at a fair amount here. And the fifth has to do, we would say, in terms of a lay precept, being careful and skillful in one's use of substances which shift consciousness of various kinds, legal and illegal. Legal and formerly illegal. And so the ethical guidelines really are about non-harming, and they're taken to be the natural expression of the development of wisdom and the development of our meditation. And one of the aspects that's not always seen so clearly is that when you look at the Noble Eightfold Path, which is really the guideline for all of our practice, of course, we have three ethical guidelines. We have three guidelines about meditation and two guidelines about wisdom. And one of the key dimensions of that model of practice is that all of the guidelines are interconnected. You don't just act ethically separate from meditation and wisdom. In fact, as we'll see when we look to how to practice ethically, meditation plays a very crucial role. Essentially, let's say I find some motivation to do something which I know is selfish, we can on the spot do meditative inquiry. What's going on in my mind? What's happening? What's going on in my body? Or we can remember certain teachings. And that's a very crucial dimension of practice that ethics is intimately connected with meditation and wisdom. It's something which is often lost in the secular mindfulness movement, which takes mindfulness out of context and doesn't keep it connected to ethics and wisdom. And some approaches do, but a lot of them don't. I remember asking actually a colleague who was teaching mindfulness in corporate settings, and I asked, how do you bring in the ethical dimension when you're teaching mindfulness in those settings? And she said, huh? So that happens a lot. You know, and it's happened historically. In Japan, in the first half of the 20th century, under what we would call fascist Japan, meditation was sometimes taught to soldiers to help them kill more efficiently. Quite striking. And so they, partly for different reasons, Zen sometimes has had not a very clear relationship to ethics for different reasons. And that was, there were actually in the, again, first half of the 20th century, people sometimes did political assassinations and thought they were following the guidelines of Zen. I've been present at apologies given by Zen teachers for what happened in the first half of the 20th century, where they lost the ethical dimension. And I've been present at those apologies, and I've heard Zen teachers say, we basically lost it. That's quite shocking. And so, living ethically is both the natural expression of wisdom and a mind of clarity and kindness. We could also use other words. We could say that it's about integrity. It's about a certain wholeness to our lives, that all the parts fit together. It's something which I think we deeply aspire to realize, to have that kind of wholeness so that every moment is an expression of our depths. You know, I remember in some of the old Hasidic teachings in the Jewish tradition, someone would say, of a teacher, I didn't come to hear him teach. I came to see how he tied his shoelaces. You get that, right? At that, down to that level of detail. The Buddha, one who is virtuous, it's a synonym for living ethically, one who is virtuous and wise shines forth like a blazing fire. And it's in various texts, it's said that keeping the precepts is like seeing the light of a fire in a dark place. It's like a poor man finding a jewel. It's like a prisoner being released. It's like returning home. The Buddha, again, not to commit evil, but to practice all good, to keep the heart pure, this is the teaching of the Buddha. So you can hear a little bit more of the centrality of ethics there, right? It's not just about the meditative development. And the ethical precepts are also very much, and this is especially true of the first ethical precept about non-harming, they're also about maintaining safety for others and for oneself. That there's a kind of safety that we need for ourselves if we're going to go more deeply. You can't go more deeply if you live unethically. The mind is going to be too scattered and a little bit frantic. Not can't be very settled if one doesn't live ethically. And it's also in large part about creating safety for others. In a sense, one, by practicing, becomes safe, or at least relatively safe, for others. It's a training as well. We follow the ethical precepts, and how do we practice? We can keep them in our attention, and then especially notice when we stray. I remember I have one friend who sometimes would start a discussion by saying, I don't know if this is in accordance with the precepts, but. And so we watch the mind. And so it's a very, very interesting, very, very interesting inquiry. Let's see if I can find this. There's a very nice passage by Gary Snyder in an interview. Let's see. He said this. I'd like to go back to the most basic Buddhist precept, which is ahimsa, or non-harming. It's my understanding that this precept is applied to all beings. Some would say that this includes even insentient beings, meaning trees, rocks, maybe even rocks, but definitely, you know, trees, plants, and so forth. Why not? It makes for a good meditation, a searching kind of examination. How to practice ahimsa, or non-harming, is a profound and wonderful question. I'll be working on this until I die. You know, it's an inquiry. Traditionally, I'll say a little bit about that, a little further about the traditional understanding, and then talk about some contemporary ways that we can practice. So the first guideline of non-harming especially goes against one of the three roots of ignorance, which is hatred. It goes against that tendency to want to hurt others, or even to want to hurt ourselves, or want to hurt or harm. And it said, one passage again by the Buddha, he said, non-harming is the distinguishing mark of the Dharma. And it's also very much related to developing kindness and warmth, compassion and love. And so I think you know that the ethical precepts are often expressed more negatively but they also refer very much to positive qualities. So it refers to uprooting, especially hatred and different forms of aversion. That could include, you know, being judgmental towards ourselves, blaming, wanting to hurt, thinking negative thoughts, and so forth. These are all forms of harming. And so we both, as in much of our practice, we both uproot and try to work through negative tendencies, and then we develop positive tendencies. That's all of our practices like that. We look at the problematic states of mind and heart and body, and we also develop beautiful qualities. Our practice always has those twin aspects, you know, that we work with. And working with the precept could be said to be following that understanding, that we both see where we fall short of the precept, right? Where is my mind going to harming? Or again, it might be, for many of us, we might not want to, you know, physically hurt people. It might take more of the form, again, of being judgmental, thinking negative thoughts of ourselves or others. And probably only in certain instances do we actually think we want to hurt physically someone. One of the benefits of doing retreats is you get to watch your mind in all sorts of varieties over, you know, days or weeks. And I've certainly seen my mind at times want to kill. It's actually helpful to see that potential is there, you know, because, you know, in some ways, if the roots of harming are there, then it's a matter of certain conditions can lead one to harm. This is what you find, again, when you look at history, or some of the histories I was mentioning, the Holocaust, whatever, right? You know, when I was at the Holocaust Museum, I heard there was I was there on a day when there was a lecture by a survivor. And he was born in 1941, so he was a little kid. He was protected in The Hague in the Netherlands by an Indonesian family who took him in. His sisters were placed with another family and eventually betrayed and killed in Auschwitz. And so what caused was a man connected with the family who I think may have been scared or may have been anti-Semitic, and he turned them in. They were girls who were 6 and 8 years old. And so we look to where the mind falls short of the precept. And again, so we have to have a certain amount of compassion, right? We see ourselves, and if we could easily become judgmental about how we fall short. So we have to really have that sense of compassion. And the nature of ethical practice is that we're always somewhat falling short. That's part of the practice. That's taken for granted. And so we just see it. And again, a lot of the benefit of taking this as a practice is that we can bring attention to it and notice things more quickly. You know, one way to practice would be to take the intention once or twice or three times a day, I'm going to try to remember the ethical precepts. You know, and you can, whatever, put it on your wall or something, or, you know, repeat it, put it on your refrigerator and follow it. You know, so on the one hand, we see where we, in a sense, fall short. On the other hand, we can develop positively the qualities of kindness through practices like loving kindness or compassion practice. And we can work like that. Traditionally, the precept was understood as going against the intentional killing of any living being. This is from the Buddha again. One must not hate any beings, all beings, not just human beings. One must not hate any being and cannot kill a living creature, even in thought. And so there's been some controversy over the years because Buddhists haven't all been vegetarians. This is in part an artifact of the fact that in India, at least, and in countries like Thailand and Burma, monks or nuns don't raise their own food, but they're dependent on the villagers nearby to get their food. And so they accept whatever is offered. And so when I stayed at monasteries in Thailand, it was awkward for me because I'm a vegetarian. I have been since I was about 19. And, you know, it was hard because the food that they ate was had meat or fish or whatever. And so it's been controversial. And there's some Buddhist groups that have taken on vegetarianism. And at some points in the history, as some of you know, there was a king in India named Ashoka who forbade even the killing of animals. This was 250 BC, BCE. And so for a lot of people, that is a direct implication of non-harming. And so that can be a question that people take to heart. Laying aside violence in respect to all beings, both those which are still and those which move. One should not kill a living creature, nor cause to kill, nor approve of others' killings. Abandoning the onslaught on breathing beings, one abstains from this without stick or sword, scrupulous, compassionate, trembling for the welfare of all living beings. You have that sense of the consciousness that can tremble for what's happening to all living beings, and it clearly comes out of the meditative training. And so we have to look at what are the roots? What are the roots of my wanting to hurt others? Or my thinking harmful thoughts about myself? What are the roots of that? You know, and one of the contemporary ways that the practice has been developed is in extending more clearly the precept on non-harming to include the social dimension and one's involvement in the social dimension. If I take a vow not to harm, what do I do when I pay taxes for a government which kills? What's my ethical responsibility? Not easy questions, right? These are like Zen koans, right? They're really can be disturbing. They can be disturbing questions to ask. Having integrity, having this full integrity in one's life, I think should be disturbing at times, right? There's a set of questions that I find very powerful, which I have read in the past. These come from the great African-American scholar and activist named W.E.B. Du Bois. I think I've given these here before. He was one of the co-founders of the NAACP. I think was the first African-American to receive a PhD from Harvard. And he very famously said in, I think, 1903, the problem of the 20th century will be the problem of the color line, 1903, right? And towards the end of his life, in the late 1950s, when he was in his late 80s, he decided to write some novels. That reminds me of, anyone who reads the Chronicle might have caught that Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who is 98, just finished a novel. Mm-hmm. Right, isn't that cool? Yeah. And anyway, so Du Bois did something similar. He was in his late 80s, and he decided to write a novel. He actually decided to write three novels. And in one of the novels, it starts off by having his protagonist ask four questions, which are really guidelines for a life of integrity, and disturbing questions. How does integrity face oppression? What does honesty do in the face of deception? What does decency do in the face of insult? how does virtue meet brute force? Those are not easy questions. And there really are questions, again, I think, are pointers to reflection and investigation about how to respond in our times, right? So, actually, I would say, on my reading, that there was a social dimension to the guideline of non-harming in the original Buddhist teachings. You could hear that in relation to all beings, right? You could hear that. But even in relation to the social community, we might say, there were, in some of the early guidelines, it said, let one not destroy life, nor cause others to destroy life, nor approve of others' killing. So there's that sense that you, and what does approve mean? You know, but it has a sense of being involved. If others are doing something, does one approve by one's silence? How does that work? Right? And so you find those, continually, those passages in which the Buddha says not to approve when others break the guidelines. Not to approve of that. Not to cause others to do that. And so, in our times, in the last 30, 40 years, a lot of teachers have wanted to interpret the guidelines in a social way. And so some of you know Thich Nhat Hanh said this, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I vow to cultivate compassion and learn ways to protect the lives of people, animals, plants, and minerals, he says. Protect minerals. And this is his reframing of the first precept. I am determined not to kill, but then he says, not to let others kill, and not to condone any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. That's quite strong, isn't it? And he said, he goes on to explain that, we cannot support any act of killing, no killing can be justified, but not to kill is not enough. We must also learn ways to prevent others from killing. We cannot say, I am not responsible. They did it, my hands are clean. If you were in Germany in the time of the Nazis, you could not say, they did it, I did not. You did not say or do anything to try to stop the killing. You were not practicing the precept. So that's a challenge, isn't it? To work with that. And again, I want to frame it more as a way to just let that be an ongoing question. Let it be a kind of ongoing reflection without necessarily having clear answers right away. But what do we do? Let it, some of you may have practiced Zen. When you practice a koan, you have this almost not easily answerable question, right? And you just keep it with you, you know, like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Oh, it's like this. No, that's not it. Oh, it's like that. And you kind of, you go through 10,000 mental gyrations on the cushion trying to answer the koan, but eventually there's some intuitive understanding. And I think this is similar. How do we respond? Maybe not as hard as that one. And so, you know, so again, I'm going to suggest two ways of practicing. One is, well, maybe three ways to practice. One is set the intention to have the ethical guideline of non-harming be there in your everyday lives, day by day. Work with intention, however that works best for you. Put it on your refrigerator, have it on your wall. So whatever reminds you to follow the precept. That's number one. Then number two, on an everyday level, just in terms of everyday activities, notice whenever there's a tendency to harm, and again, this could be even a nasty thought or a nasty statement. Just notice it. When do you do that? Especially we want to look for when someone has done something perhaps that could be interpreted as tending to harm you, maybe a mean for our lives, maybe a mean statement, right? someone says something mean to you, notice if you say something mean right back. Because we want to look at the roots of harming. A lot of the roots of harming are in greed, hatred, and delusion. And a lot of the roots are in someone has done harm to me, I do harm to someone else, or I do harm to myself. Right? That's the logic of how harming occurs. It's cyclical. And so we want to look at that. We want to look especially when someone maybe is reactive towards you, says something nasty, mean, judgmental, blaming. Notice your own mind. Do I tend to at least think something nasty, blaming, judgmental right back? Most of us will tend to, at least some. Maybe it depends on the strength of what comes at us and who says it. Right? But we can look at that. So in that sense, working with this practice is that working with the teaching of the two arrows that we've looked at a lot. You know, the teaching that when I receive some, when I have some pain, I may react by inflicting pain on the other. Look at that. That's no different in some ways from some of the things which we would look at a distance and say, how unethical. The root may be very similar. People have been hurt, they hurt others. People have fear, they may hurt others or say hateful things which lead to hurting others. Right? So look at that in oneself. You have to be honest. And it's not all pretty, right? We see and look for every tendency to harm. And again, for a lot of us, much of it will come through words and thoughts more than through deeds. Look at that. Okay? So that's first practice, intention. Actually, along the way, I've added another one. Okay, so I'm going to have four practices. Intention, try to be mindful, investigate, be on the lookout for the mind doing any form of harming, especially in word and thought, even small. Study it. You know, this is how we have insight into the precept. We study when we are, in a sense, violating it. Thirdly, see if you can cultivate some quality of kindness and compassion, even just for a few minutes a day. You know, and if you, hopefully all of us know some kind of loving kindness practice or some practice to cultivate warmth towards oneself and others. Okay. And does anyone not have a background in loving kindness practice or compassion practice? You can raise your hand. Okay, good. Okay. And then fourthly, consider the larger social dimension. And what would it mean to respond to the harming by others? Sometimes our government, right? What would that mean? And of course, some of the harming is going on. You know, we're talking about difficult situations of larger systems. So in a sense, all of us, I think, are contributing to the climate disruption. Maybe in smaller ways than some others, but if we drove here, we're contributing. Right? And so look into that. Look into that. How am I harming by my everyday actions, and how might I respond? How about to the harming by others? You know, that's going, you know, however you perceive it. How do I respond? Look into that. That may be a matter of reflection. You know, like, how do I respond? How do I have my life in integrity, following the ethical precept of non-harming? At a time when there's a lot of harm that's happening in multiple systems, whether it's ecological, social, political, and so forth. How do I respond? Okay, so let me see if I have a nice quote to end. Maybe I'll end by reading the five ethical precepts, and if you want to, you can take them internally as I do so, okay? It's up to you. First precept, for the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from the taking of life. I'll just let this sit with you and see what the meaning is for yourself. And that's the one we'll especially focus on, the first precept. Second precept, for the sake of training, I undertake the precept not to take that which is not given. Third precept, for the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from sexual misconduct. Fourth precept, for the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from unskillful speech. Fifth precept, for the sake of training, I undertake the precept to abstain from intoxicants that cause heedlessness. So we have now, if you took the precepts, those who took it just now, we have formally taken the precepts, and they're good for at least the next week. So, thank you, and we have some time for any questions, discussion. So remember, there are four types of practice. Okay.
Usually I don't do this, but I wonder if I could say something first. I just really appreciate the tie-in to compassion and the thing that you said about people being hurt, and it reminds me of just a saying that I've heard that just really sticks with me, is that hurt people hurt people.
That's right.
And it really helps me with practicing the precepts when I remember that, because it's so That's easy right. to fall into judgment. So.
Right. That's so key. Yeah, thank you. And really, it's a very simple, down-to-earth expression of the 2 hours teaching. You know, which hurting others or ourselves comes out of, typically out of feeling hurt. So it's, you know.
Do I need to just learn how to live with the ants in my kitchen?
Say again?
Do I need to learn how to live with the ants in my kitchen?
Yes.
Do I need, question is, do I need to learn to live with the ants in my question?
Quick kitchen.
Oh, yeah. Do I need to live with the ants in my kitchen?
Good question.
My answer is, good question. You know, it actually, are you planning to be here next week? Okay. Why don't you ask that question? You can, you know,
make friends this week and come next week.
Well, I'm not, you know, there are different ways to respond, but one, you know, that in itself is it's like an ethical challenge, right? And it requires sensitivity, but I think I would actually, turn the question back to you and say, investigate that. Because investigating it is way, way better than me giving my view. Because then you can really, in the week, let's say, just have a sense maybe of the 10 or 15 different nuances of this. What are the factors that, to be wise, I have to be conscious of to answer that question? And so, how does that sound? Okay. Okay, great. Yeah, thank you.
I mean, condoning dealing with people that you know that believe in hunting.
Yeah.
I have relatives who believe in hunting.
Mm.
And they only hunt for food, but they do hunt. And I find that it would cause great, the times I have suggested, well, maybe this isn't a good thing to do, this causes great dissension in the family because it splits it amongst various things. So I have no idea really how I can stop one of my family members
from killing. Yeah.
But so I don't talk about it, but maybe there's a better way. It's been a conundrum for a number of years.
Yeah, again, I think it's a deep question. And again, there are complexities, right? I mean, you're clear about how you want to act.
No, I'm not interested in hunting at all.
You're clear.
Yeah.
And so it's a question of, you know, if you follow what Thich Nhat Hanh said, interpreting the first precept, do not let others kill.
Right.
How do you interpret that? And so it really forces us to ask questions like, to what extent am I complicit in killing? You know, which we are. You know. And I think it probably another reference point that could be helpful might be to even look at Native American attitudes towards hunting. They certainly hunted, but there is a different understanding of what killing meant, I think. And it could be interesting to look into that. And so I think, and then from a practical point of view, you know, would it be possible actually to have an open discussion with the with your relatives, you know? And I don't know, just to see where that goes, but to listen carefully. Right? I mean, generally speaking, it's only been very recently in this culture, you know, that from Christian or Jewish points of view, that the killing of non-humans has been considered an ethical dimension. That's pretty recent, right? And so after what does skillful means mean? Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Thank you for this. As you were speaking, I'm thinking we'll never run out of homework if that's the homework. It's a lot of homework.
Yeah.
But I wanted not miss an opportunity to mention Dharma Voices for Animals for any practitioner who's interested in learning about our food choices and the Dharma. There's a website and an organization that I helped found called Dharma Voices for Animals. It's dharmavoicesforanimals.org. We have a mentoring program. If anybody wants to move toward vegetarian and doesn't know how, we're happy to help you. So I'm offering my services and the organization's services to anyone who's interested in going in that direction.
Yeah, it seems that it seems that vegetarian or vegan diets is also, as a lot of people have shown in the last 5 or 10 years, also very significant in terms of climate issues. Right, there have been studies, right, that have shown that upwards of 50% of greenhouse gases are linked to the raising of animals for eating. Right? So that's pretty striking. So these are interwoven. Right. So maybe time for just one more, maybe at the back. Yeah.
On next Saturday, the 30th, there'll be a national demonstrations, rallies and protests to get Trump to return the children he kidnapped to their refugee parents. I'm going to moveon.org to find one there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Good. So, yeah, for a lot of people, that I know, the ethical precepts were actually the foundation for action in the world. It really gives the guidance and the basis for people acting. And it's a challenge, isn't it, to say, because, you know, many of us think, oh, I live ethically because I don't, you know, in my face-to-face interactions, I do pretty well. Right? But what would it mean to have the one's ethical guideline, one's ethical value, be there for all the parts of one's life, including this very challenging social dimension? That's what I want all of us, including myself, to investigate for the next week. See what we find. See what you find. See what the challenges are. And again, perhaps looking at history can be helpful. Think back. I think that's very useful. Think back. What would I have done if I was a non-Jewish German in 1934? What would I have done? What would I have done if I was a white person in Mississippi in 1934?